Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
My next guest this morning is the founder and head of the Nobel Peace Prize winning Center for Civil Liberties. She is a Ukrainian human rights lawyer who travels the world speaking on peace, women's issues and the plight of the world's most vulnerable. Oleksandra Matvichuk is in Dublin to speak at a conference about the global legacy of Daniel O'Connell. I'll have you know, we'll come to that in a little bit. She joins me in studio now. You're very welcome to Dublin. Can I talk to you first about President Zelensky? There are a lot of critics within Ukraine at the moment that fear that he is on a journey and Ukrainian politics is on a journey away from democratic norms. Would that be your assessment?
We have a mass protest now in Ukraine. It's going on after Ukrainian parliament adopted the law which put anti-corruption bodies into dependence of Office of General Prosecutor. And
these were two independent bodies that the president has sought to bring under his control now.
Yes, and it's unfortunately very naturally for society in a war, because war, it's poison. War has its own logic. War dictates centralization. War dictates limitation of human rights and freedom due to security requirements. And it's, once again, unfortunately, it's naturally. And that is why it's so important to be confident that this logic of the war are proportional and not limited our freedom just to extent which is needed. And that is why when this law was adopted and signed by president, the Ukrainian society react. And I think it's a very positive sign. It's not a sign of weakness, it's a sign of strength that even during the large-scale war, we still democracy. People still feel the responsibility for the development of their country. And they started this mass protest and push Ukrainian president to change his mind. And now the new draft of law was registered in parliament. And this week we are waiting that it will be adopted and this anti-corruption body will be protected, which once again show that even during the war, despite this logic which dictates centralization, Ukrainian people, Ukrainian society push Ukrainian authorities to go in the right direction.
You could frame it, as you have just done, as a positive. I wonder, though, how it would be seen in Moscow. Might it not be interpreted as a sign of division within Ukrainian society?
Moscow don't understand Ukrainian society at all. Because dictators, they see to all events through the one concrete prism. They don't believe in power of people. They always think it's someone control, there are some politic interests behind, and so on and so forth. They can't understand the nature of revolution of dignity. They know nothing about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. They failed to understand it, and that's why they lost in 2022 their plan to occupy Ukraine just in 3 or 4 days.
It's very interesting, though, to listen to you, a human rights lawyer who I would imagine in the usual set of circumstances would think that there was no higher calling than the law and the rigorous observation of the law, to admit, well, when you're in a war of national existence, you have to let certain things go. The difficulty for you, though, is where is that line? What do you decide is important and isn't important?
Yes, once again, this criteria of proportionality, because we know that we have the logic of the war, but also we have a logic of democratization, because we decided 11 years ago as people of our country to start the ever-integration process, to return to European civilized dimension and to got to a chance to build a country where the rights of everybody are protected, government is accountable, judiciary is independent, and police do not beat students who are peacefully demonstrating. So we're just trying to balance between these two logics.
What is the best thing for Ukrainian society now then? Is it for somebody to challenge Zelensky's presidency? Is it to try and have an election process during a war? Or do Ukrainians need to keep faith with their existing president?
A year ago, more than 100 civil society organizations signed an appeal that we can't conduct election during the war. First, it's prohibited by our constitution to organize any election during the martial law. And second, is a practical point of view, it's very difficult to organize because you have to solve a lot of problems. We have 7.5 million of people abroad. We have part of territory occupied. And we have large-scale war.
You have more important things to do, really.
It means how we can organize electoral process for soldiers in trenches. It's the most active part of Ukrainian society. A lot of them volunteeringly joined armed forces in 2022. So it doesn't mean that Ukrainian society provide the full mandate to do everything what you want to do for two politicians, because there are other ways how to preserve democracy even during the large-scale war. And one of these is local democracy, because local democracy and power of people on local level, it's a survival source for Ukraine.
Okay. So President Zelensky need not worry at the moment, is what you are saying. Does that give him too free a hand to do what he wants?
This protest once again remind our president that he has to fulfill the will of people. And people in Ukraine see their fight against corruption as a step toward European dimension. And that's why he can't touch those bodies.
Okay. Is there anybody else who wants the job, who would be suitable for the job and who would be popular enough with the Ukrainian people? I mean, I ask that question from a pragmatic point of view. Is there anybody else who realistically would get the support of the Ukrainian people to replace Volodymyr Zelensky?
Look, we're in a large-scale war. People think how to survive. They don't think about political battles. After the World War period, I'm sure that a lot of bright personalities will emerge, because these dramatic times provide people from different fields of society an opportunity to express the best in us, to be courageous, to fight for freedom, to make a difficult but right choices, to take burden of responsibility and to help each other. And people will remind about this after the post-war period. But now we have to defend our country, our people and our democratic choice. And parallel, we have to implement our democratic choice. And despite the war, we have to do reforms. And this is our goal. We are focused on this, not on political electoral battles.
Talk to me beyond those, the battle over those two anti-corruption agencies and their independence. How is the rule of law being observed in Ukraine during the course of this war?
We have a lot of problems with the rule of law. Because let me remind you that just 11 years ago, we was under authoritarian ruler. And just 11 years ago, millions of people in Ukraine stood up their voice against pro-Russian, corrupt, authoritarian government. And they peacefully demonstrated just for a chance to build the society where the rights of everybody are protected. So we have just 11 years to start reform after the authoritarian regime collapsed. And we are doing this reform not during the peaceful time. We are doing this reform in time of war, because immediately when authoritarian regime collapsed, in order to stop us on this democratic way Russia invaded. Russia occupied Crimea, part of the eastern regions of Ukraine, and 3 years ago extended this war to the large-scale invasion because Putin is not afraid of NATO. Putin is afraid of the idea of freedom.
Your own organization had been set up to monitor civil rights and human rights within Ukraine, but naturally, once the invasion started, you switched your attention to Russia. Tell me about that work and what it is that you try to achieve.
This war turns people into the numbers because the scale of war crime grows so large that it's impossible to recognize all the stories. So what we are literally doing, we are returning people their names. We believe that people are not numbers and life of each person matter. And that is why we document every criminal episode which was committed in the smallest village in the country. Let me share with you one story from our database. This is a story of 10-year-old boy Ilya from Mariupol. When Russians tried to siege Mariupol, they didn't allow to open green corridors to evacuate civilians. And Ilya and his mother, like other people in the city, have to hide in the basement from Russian shelling. They melted snow to have water, and they made fires to cook at least some food. But when supplies ran out, they were forced to go out, and suddenly they appeared in the center of Russian shelling. Ilya's mother was hit in her head, and the boy's legs were torn. With the last strength, his mother took her son to the friend apartment. It was no medical assistance because prior to this, Russians deliberately destroyed maternity hospital and entire medical infrastructure in the city. So in this friend apartment, they just lay down on a couch and hugged each other. They were laying like this for several hours. And this 10-year-old boy told to my colleague how his mother died and got frozen right in his arms. So this is kind of stories which we are documented. We have in our database 88,000 of such stories.
With what intention, beyond giving those people their name and recording these histories, do you hope that they might form the basis of prosecutions in the future?
Why in the future? We have to do it now. There is no reason to wait to when the war will end. And let me explain this. If we want to prevent wars in the future, we have to punish the states and the leaders who start such wars in present, because all the atrocities which we are documented, it's a result of their leadership decision to start the aggressive war. It's a common sense. But in the whole history of humankind, we have only one such a precedent. It was Nuremberg trial, where Nazi war criminals were tried only after Nazi regime had collapsed. But we live in a new century. We must move further. Justice is not privilege to winners. Justice is a basic human right. It means that we cannot wait. We must make justice independent on the fact when and how the war will end. And that is why, a month ago, the Council of Europe signed the historical agreement to create a special tribunal on aggression and to hold Putin and top political leadership and high military command of Russian state accountable without waiting the end of this war.
Your institution is, as I said at the outset, a Nobel Peace Prize winning organization. Is it a comfortable position? Is it a contradictory position for you to work for that institution, the holder of that illustrious prize, but also to support the continued prosecution of our war?
But justice is precondition to peace. Justice is precondition to peace. All this hell which we face in Ukraine, it's a result of total impunity which Russia enjoyed for decades. Let me remind, Russian soldiers committed horrible crimes in Chechnya, in Moldova, in Georgia, in Mali, in Libya, in Syria, in other countries of the world. They have never been punished. They believe they can do whatever they want. I personally interviewed hundreds of people who survived Russian captivity. men and women, mostly civilian. They told me how they were beaten, raped, smashed into wooden boxes, their fingers were cut, their nails were torn away, their nails were drilled, they were electrically shocked through their genitalia. One woman told me how her eye was decoyed with a spoon. There is no legitimate reason in doing such things. There is also no military necessity in it. Russians have done these horrible things only because they could, because they enjoyed impunity for decades, and that is why we must break this circle.
Before I let you go, you're talking at a conference on the global legacies of Daniel O'Connell alongside the Taoiseach. That takes place tomorrow and Wednesday at Trinity College. Admission is free if anybody is interested. Of what relevance is Daniel O'Connell to your current situation?
I feel a huge, deep link between Daniel O'Connell's legacy and our fight for freedom and human dignity in Ukraine. Because Daniel O'Connell, he stood up his voice against any oppression in the world. And what is important, he believed in the power of ordinary people. He knew that ordinary people have much great impact that they can even imagine, that ordinary people can change the history. And this is what I think we have to remind ourselves, because we get used to thinking in the categories of states and interstate organizations. But look to Ukrainian example. 3 years ago, when large-scale war started, nobody believed that Ukrainians can resist to such enormous opposing power. I was in Kyiv. I refused to evacuate. And I saw how international organization evacuated their personnel. They left people alone. But millions of Ukrainians told, we don't care that Russia has enormous military power and nuclear weapon. We will fight for our freedom and for our human dignity.
That event, people can get tickets on Eventbrite. It takes place, as I said, tomorrow and Wednesday in Trinity College. And Oleksandra Matvichuk, thank you very much for both coming to Dublin, sharing that with us and joining us in studio this morning.
Thank you very much.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.